the news. With Honorable Lady of the News, Penelope Underjacks.
It's now been almost a week since the nation's most loved podcasting sensation. Oh no, hold on a moment. We've got another story coming in regarding the failing writers, whoever they might be. Apparently, they've not been seen since making their way to a remote cabin on the side of a spooky mountain somewhere. Family members are mildly annoyed and checking life insurance policies as we speak. We approached Professor Dr. Sir Pettigrew Mythingthorpe, head of literature at Oxbridge Home for the Hard of Learning, and asked him what the disappearance of the failing writers meant to the world of literature.
Well, I think it's fair to say the square root of nothing and a fucking half. Set of imbeciles. Won't be missed.
Thank you, Professor Doctor, sir. More on this story later, if we run out of other more important and interesting news.
I'll be honest, lad, it's been a bit of a weird week, that, just sat in the cabin waiting. I don't know if we should have... We should have probably gone home or something in between, should we?
I thought it was quite pleasant.
The fire was
nice. And quiet.
I don't even know what day it is.
So why, hang on, why are we still here?
Well, we're still here because some of our lovely listeners have sent in their ghost stories.
That's right.
Oh, yes. That's
and now is the time for us to read them out.
Ooh.
Should we gather back around the fire again?
Fire, yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Come on, lads. Okay, shall I kick us off?
Yeah, what have you got? What have you got?
I have got a story, a ghost story called In the House of Trembling Madness by A.B. Finlayson. And it goes a little something like this. The silence had a strange weight to it that pulled him slowly from sleep, teasing him away from the edge of gin-soaked oblivion. He didn't jolt awake, there was none of that. For one thing, his head was too heavy, stuffed with the scratching wire wool of an impending hangover. But there was something different in the air, something deep and unsettling. Instincts are often the first casualty of the inebriate, but some are so ingrained in the self-preservation they can't be drowned. More's the pity. Marcus opened his eyes without lifting his head from the table and took in the dark room. Small candles flickered in their braziers on the white stone walls. Thick wooden beams rose to a point, framing the stag head mounted on its varnished shield. The glassy black eyes stared back at him, given life by the dancing flame. Watching, judging, bastard thing. It unnerved the barman at the best of times, let alone in the middle of the night. He stretched, a little, not entirely ready to commit just yet. But his head was heavy with booze and interrupted sleep, and he needed to crack his neck. He glanced away from the stag and up to the skylight set high in the triangular ceiling. Frost clawed at the glass, curling in from the edges of the frame, and behind it rose the grand edifice of the minster. The great Gothic cathedral stood, as it always had, staring down over the city, peering into the misty snickleways and side streets, towering over the roads and rooftops. Or, in this case, looking straight through the high window into the house of trembling madness. Marcus shivered. The stag, or God himself? No wonder he felt like he was being watched. His eyes adjusted to the gloom, and the rest of the pub slowly emerged from sleep and shadow. The tables were clean, that's one thing. At least he did his job before drinking himself stupid. Somewhere in the city, a church bell rang out with brass insolence. Once, twice, thrice, the witching hour. Merry Christmas, he muttered, and shivered again, not happy with the way his voice drifted away. Just a few short hours ago, the pub had been a vibrant, thrumming hive of activity, but they were all gone now. Marcus had closed up, locked up, he glanced down and groaned, and cocked up again. He stood up, ignoring the immediate problem on the table. But as he moved, the shadows on the edge of the bar moved with him. He turned sharply and winced as pain lanced into his forehead. Jesus, he muttered, kneading his eye. Anyone there? He felt like an idiot saying it, but the building was strange, and each snug and hollow was made stranger when the lights were out. His words hung limp in the empty air, and a knot of childish nervousness threaded its way from his belly to his spine. Dark tinsel moved in some unseen breeze, casting spidery shadows. bloody Christmas, he muttered, moving to the bar and pouring another drink. Mistletoe and wine and all that. The time to reminisce on what once was and what you once had, to be homesick for something no longer in existence. Funny how the magic doesn't follow you into adulthood, but the bloody fears have no problem hanging on. He stood still and listened. Silence. But there was something. He knew it in the same way you know you're being watched. He knew it in the same way you know you're not alone in a seemingly empty room. He looked around. The stag, the minster, the shadows, the polished tabletops glistening silver in the meager winter starlight spilling in from above. But beneath them was a deep, fathomless black. Marcus swallowed the rising fear of shadows under the bed. Then he swallowed his drink and knelt down. It was like being pulled underwater or stepping into a cave. Ducking below the level of the wooden tables, he felt himself cross a threshold, felt himself submerge. And the shiver held on, stubbornly refusing to let go, no matter how much he tried to shake it off. There was something there. He was certain of it. But then, inexplicably, it moved. The nothing moved. Fear had fingers of ice, but booze was warm.
Oi! Seriously, mate, we locked up hours ago.
Marcus narrowed his eyes, squinting into the shadows beneath the tables, but they just stared back, and the cold moved behind him. He shivered and remembered to breathe. Suddenly, a violent buzz drilled into the table above his head and shocked him upright. He swore and cracked his head on the wood, snatching at the forgotten phone as he stumbled. The light was sharp, blinding. It chased the shadows around the walls, circling the room like a veiled carousel. And in the center, a message from Claire. Marcus, enough is enough. It's been years. The papers are signed. Let it go. I don't appreciate the drunk videos from you and your friend. Merry Christmas, X. Always with the kiss, he sighed. Always. Wait, what friend? He scrolled through the depressive evidence reel of self-pity. Increasingly drunk, increasingly desperate. And there it was, a video. He pressed play and watched in stunned, embarrassed silence as his inebriated self begged his ex-wife to take him back. Behind him, an old man with a scraggly beard peered over his shoulder, wide-eyed and hopeful. Marcus turned and felt like an idiot. There was no one there, of course, just the frosty emptiness of the closed bar. He turned back to his phone and looked at the timestamp. 1:38, he muttered. Should have kicked him out before then. Oh, well. He swiped the camera open with his thumb and held the phone in front of his face. Look, Claire, he began, but then froze as the old man appeared from the shadows behind him.
I...
So how about
Lovely.
That? Good Lovely. Location, isn't it? A pub. Not read a ghost story in a pub before. And a pub in York as well.
Yeah.
A real pub in York.
Yeah, they are quite spooky places after hours.
Yeah, once the lights are off. And
And York is supposedly one of the most haunted places in Britain, of course.
Yes.
I've been on a couple of... You've been on a ghost walk.
I have. Did I do one in York?
They're quite good fun.
One in somewhere. Or did I do it in Leeds?
You don't think of Leeds as being that haunted, really, do you? But I suppose...
Edinburgh.
Well, that would be
it was
good.
Somewhere north.
Somewhere north. Were you drunk again, Dave? Was it one of your drunk stories?
Yeah, quite possibly.
Was it Las Vegas?
Yeah. Anyway, that was good. I liked the good chills when he sees the guy behind him in the camera. That was a nice bit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good work.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. I like a backstory as well. Do you know when you... when you make a ghost story about more than, like, just a ghost, if you know what I mean. Like, it's about the character and their psychology and the emotional state of them. And that kind of sucks you in then, because you've got the reader to care a little bit about them, and then you can hit them with the thrills and the spills. But yeah, I thought that was very nice.
But it also, like, the setting of the pub also helps with that establishing the doubt, doesn't it? Because you can never tell, is this stuff happening?
Or
is it the figment of an alcohol-fueled
exactly.
imagination?
Yeah. And a stranger in a pub wouldn't be that weird, would it, really?
I mean, it would at 3 o'clock in the morning, but it's not that weird.
Not that weird.
Yeah, I might have got stuck in the bogs or something. You know what I mean? But yeah, very nice. Who wants to go next?
I'll jump in next if you want. We've got our long-time loyal listener and previous competition winner, Craig Margolis, has sent in a Lovecraft carol. "It's not here," I lamented, confirmed by a second rifling through my bags. I made a point of rereading The Trials of the Grasping, Covetous Old Sinner each December's end, and to that purpose had bought a rare edition, which I had thoughtlessly left behind. Pity, as I could think of no better spot for this annual rite than a centuries-old house, first built for a sloop captain, now an internet rental. Located not in the jolly old, but the New England, specifically Marblehead, the quaintest seaside village of the region, at least by my reckoning. And I should know, I was raised here. I left for school, later my parents for retirement when age compelled a flight south to warmer climes. Long between visits and having some business in Boston, I decided to stay for the holidays. This, my first night, coincided with the winter solstice. The wife and kids would follow when school let out. Until then, I had meant Dickens to be my evening companion. There was no television, indeed no nods to the 21st century whatsoever. Only a few sticks of antique furniture and a four-poster. This was how I wanted it. Lately overindulging in social media and doom-scrolling, I had resolved to unplug and spend the candlelit evening with my favourite characters. But bereft of Scrooge, Marley and Christmas ghosts of various tenses, I would have to find other entertainment. Surely there were books about. Vacation homes came stocked with them. My hunch proved correct, as I happened upon a shelf filled with fluff, beech reeds for the summer crowd, unsuitable for the season. Then my eyes fell on a leather binding among the paperbacks. A Lovecraft collection. Odd fellow indeed, that company. Never having read him, though aware of his standing among connoisseurs of the supernatural, I began to flip. An introduction explained its presence among the pulp. Lovecraft Country, so-called, encompassed the elder settlements of my birth state. Salem of the witch trials restyled Arkham, Innsmouth as nearby Newburyport, and my own Marblehead, Kingsport. All settings for his eldritch offerings. I settled in with book and bottle, only to raise my eyes some unknown hour later, taper guttering and whiskey nearly gone. It was well into the year's longest night, and with legs cramped by so long sitting, I decided to stretch them with a stroll. By day, utiled Marblehead modelled for Rockwell. Town folk dressed trees and hung wreaths, festooned doors and windows with verdant greens and warm reds. That morning I smiled at rosy-cheeked children bundled up, heaving sleds to snowy Fort Sewell, their parents in tow with thermoses, no doubt full of hot chocolate. The night told a different tale. A fog had risen, spilling into the narrow lanes, as if bergs of dry ice were dropped in the harbour and their mists blown ashore. Dim spheres of lonely streetlights cast shadows on crowded clapboard structures. The walls stood at irregular angles plumbed by shipwrights long gone. I shuddered and walked on, my footfalls punctuating the whispers of leafless limbs bending in the breeze. Passing a churchyard, I glanced at the crumbling slates, crooked teeth in a grey mouth, and quickened my stride and held my breath, instinctually dodging grave dust. Hoping for sleep, I rounded back when I spotted figures processing down Washington Street. They held lanterns, but their faces were shrouded. This would have hardly made for a pretty Christmas pageant in daylight, rendered all the less so by the town's clock chime announcing winter's coming. Perhaps this was some recent unfamiliar custom, a rehearsal for midnight mass. Yet it had an inexplicable ancient feel. They chanted as they trod, words I could not catch from where I was. My curiosity piqued. I followed at a distance, cloaked by the fog. Their march ended at the old townhouse, the colonial-era city hall, its golden-hued exterior tarnished by the darkness to a pale yellow. They stepped inside, two by two, as if entering the Ark. I waited for alarms to shriek and summon the police. None sounded. None came. Still, I hesitated, An unspoken caution held me back. Having gone this far, however, I would not turn away without witnessing the weird spectacle I supposed occurred within. I pressed on only to find they had descended into the cellar, and I pursued into the musty dank, colder than outside. There they huddled. The covered space amplified their chants. Their smoke breath wafted to the exposed rafters. Even now I couldn't comprehend their song, though at least I could see clearly. At their front stood an altar around which the lantern bearers gathered, a wizened figure in their midst. His elongated face tinted the same green shade as tide-gathered kelp. He intoned from an oversized codex held by flanking acolytes. I now knew why I couldn't understand. The verse was in a strange tongue, though I could decipher the Latin characters on the cover. Printed there was Necronomicon, which I recognized from the compendium, at a single exhortation voiced over and over again. Cthulhu, Cthulhu, Cthulhu. It grew louder, reverberating, such that I made to block my ears and go. I found I could not. Struck still by fear or some other unknown force, my skin prickled, my tongue cleaved to the roof of my mouth. Their canticle continued. Cthulhu, Cthulhu, Cthulhu. Not at all the carol I hoped for my homecoming. The wizard howled the hateful word. Steam from his mouth congealed into the shape of some sea creature. Tentacles framing its face, gaping maw at its centre. Transfixed by the terrible thing, I hardly noticed the fish-faced priest wrapping his scaly arm about my shoulders. Gently, as if a father guiding a wayward son, he led me to the altar, on which lay a steel, shiny and sharp. I willed to wake, grasping at my bedpost to find Christmas Day had come. Alas, the old god first required a solstice sacrifice.
Bit of a sort of ghost story expert, isn't he?
Well, he won the Halloween competition.
He did. I mean, he's very good at
it. That's what I meant by what I said.
I'm a little bit worried about him, though. That I don't know if he's been eating seafood late at night a lot recently or something, because this was very much sea creature related, and the poem he sent previously, the last thing he sent into us before that was tentacle.
He does like a tentacle.
I think he does go for the tentacles quite a lot.
There are. I liked the kind of I'm going to call them strains of humour at the end there. There was a sort of cheeky knowingness in the. I hardly noticed the fish-faced priest wrapping his scaly arm about my shoulders. And then there's a really nice line, gently, as if a father guiding a wayward son.
Yeah.
I thought that was very good. Classic Margolian knowingness.
It is very Margolian, yeah.
Margolian.
And obviously interesting, because that is where he, around where he grew up and stuff.
Oh, yeah. So there's that's a right, kind he of said.
In Margolia.
Very close to Margolia.
Out to Margolia, yeah,
yeah. Funny and disturbing.
Indeed.
Very
thank
good.
Thank you for that, Craig. Yeah. Much appreciated, very as good. Always.
Davey, what have you got for us?
I've got Stealth on the Shelf by Steve Salisbury.
Salisbury?
I don't
know. Yeah.
It's quite a plain name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Steve. Like Salisbury plain.
Oh.
Straight over our heads.
It's a geography joke. So they never go down well, geography jokes, to be honest.
No. Right, come on, let's get serious. Stealth on the Shelf by Steve Salisbury. Stephen Salisbury. Stealth on the Shelf by Stealth on the Shelf by Steve. It's insanity that we are no longer allowed to call them crazy. The word dances on my tongue, begging to be spoken every time I see them, even more so now that it's 4 a.m. on Christmas Day morning and the five usual suspects are in the rec room doing their thing. Dave sits with his Santa hat on, inside out, pushing plastic coins into a Connect Four game. Grace is still knitting her imaginary scarf. She started it in October. She tells me that it's nearly finished, but she has been saying that since Halloween. Tommy sits by his typewriter, hammering keys like he knows what he's doing. I often wonder what masterpieces he would create if he would just stop tearing each page up and starting over again. I hear mumbling from the corner of the room and see John deep in conversation with the Christmas tree. The baubles and tinsel have been carefully placed on the floor because, apparently, trees don't like that kind of thing. I know I will get fired if they catch me with my phone, but I don't care. I hate working Christmas, and if this is the one little scrap of joy I'm going to get this morning, then sod 'em. I will cling to my device like my uncle does a turkey leg. I peer down and open my secret camera app. The little device is hidden inside a Christingle orange. There's no way the girls will be going anywhere near fruit when they're a quality streak waiting to be unwrapped, even if there are stale dolly mixtures skewered to it with a toothpick. The image comes to life and I jump. Denise has put the elf on the shelf right up against the lens. The cow. Its mischievous little face looks even weirder up close. She knew I'd be checking to see if the girls had come down for their presents. I love my wife, but she is such a child. I hate that elf, though. I don't even remember when they became a thing. It certainly wasn't a thing when I was a kid, thank goodness. Freaky little bastards. He doesn't like you watching. I look up, palming my phone into the pocket of my uniform. The thin blue fabric will never conceal the shape, but I can keep my hand in there for a while. I look around. I'm still alone. Kathy went to make a brew half an hour ago and she still hasn't come back. I bet she's snoozing in the kitchen, the crafty mare. He doesn't like you watching. I smile as I see Phil in the corner, his eyes fixed on the CCTV camera encased in a wire mesh cage in the corner of the room.
What's that, Phil? Who doesn't like me watching?
I chuckle and shake my head. Phil hasn't spoken to anyone except that camera for 6 months. Slowly, he turns and looks my way, and I feel a chill flow through my body. His cold eyes stare towards me. Not at me, exactly, but through me. A smile teases the edge of his mouth as he nods once, and then returns to his silent CCTV vigil. Fucking crazies, I mutter, and leave the rec room. I need a cuppa to warm me up. Kathy can wake up and babysit for a while. I pause outside the kitchen and pull my phone out of my pocket, cursing my stupidity for not turning it off as I see the screen is still on. I bet my trousers were glowing like my dick was radioactive. I look at the screen and chuckle as I realise what Denise is doing. That sodding elf. She's got up early to start on the vegetables and has moved the little bugger. I can see the room clearly now its ugly little head has moved. She's put him in my armchair, one little stocking-clad leg crossed over the other as it stares at the camera with its dead little eyes. I remember she called my little camera Stealth on the Shelf, and this is just her way of messing with me. What are you doing out here? Kathy's staring at me, a mug of steaming tea in each hand. I was coming to find you. Shit, you stupid idiot. You can't leave Phil alone in there, not on Christmas morning. Look, I said, slipping the phone into my pocket again. He's fine. He even looked at me. Kathy's eyes widened. She seemed paler. He did what? Yeah, he looked at me, just after he told me that someone didn't like being watched. I can see Kathy's hands are shaking. Tea is sploshing onto the floor. I reach out to take the cups, but I'm scalded by hot water. For fuck's sake, Kathy! I scream. My outburst seems to bring her back from wherever it was she had gone. Sorry, she said. It's just this place. You know I can get under your skin. Yeah, I nod, blowing gently on my red raw hands. Especially with Phil. Especially today, poor sod. You know that he watched his house burn down one Christmas. His wife and kids died. He tells everyone he saw the one who did it. Hell, even reckons he saw that the bastard had dismantled the smoke detectors before he torched the place. What? Well, if he saw all this, why didn't he stop him? Kathy sighed. Saw it on his home CCTV, he did. Poor bastard. My hands have stopped hurting. I watch Kathy walk away and reach for my phone. On the screen, I see him. The elf is under the tree, a square 9-volt battery at his feet and a broken plastic disc with lumps of sealing plaster stuck to it. Suddenly, he turns his head, staring through the camera lens. He nods his head once, then he strikes a match.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That gave me the good old-fashioned creeps.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Something about dolls. dolls and things, isn't it?
Exactly. I think that with that, I think it's like the it's like the slow dawning of understanding what's going on, but you sort of don't want it to be true. Do you know what I mean? It's like you know what's coming, but you're desperately thinking, please don't let that be the thing. Oh, God, it is the thing.
There's just something inherently creepy about
Excellent.
It.
Excellent, I thought that. Very
it's
good.
Odd, really, how Toy Story became such a successful child's franchise when the idea of toys coming alive is so horrifying.
Yeah. But they lent on that very well in Toy Massively Story, didn't they, with the bad toys?
Yes.
The reject toys and stuff. Yeah. They were That was freaky.
Oh, yeah, that's true,
that
yeah.
That was freaky. But the whole Elf on the Shelf thing. It's just ripe for pick. Steve was right to pick it because it's just ripe for being weird and scary, isn't it?
Little elves moving all about the house.
Yeah. Mm. How are kids not utterly freaked out by that?
It's an odd thing, isn't it? Stuff that's like just acceptable to kids suddenly becomes terrifying.
You're right.
Have you seen that movie? I can't remember what it's called now. It's Anthony Hopkins and he's got a ventriloquist dummy that.
No, but I've seen an old black and white film. It's called something like In the Dead of Night or something like that. God, what's it called? And it's almost like a sketch show of creepy stories. It's almost like a sort of Twilight Zone-y type thing. It's quite good. It's kind of fun. But that sounds like a similar thing. I wonder if that's a remake.
Yeah, I don't know. He's like a not very good ventriloquist or something, and then his doll comes to life and it sort of possesses.
Yeah, that sounds like the same story. Yeah. Interesting. See? Creepy.
Yeah.
Mm. Isn't it? It's a ventriloquist dummy is the. Have you ever seen.
Orville's Christmas special.
No, Goosebumps. Kids film.
No, I haven't.
Sort of kids creepy horror-y type, horror light film. It's good. It's good fun. Ooh. Jack Black. Well, anyway, there's one of them in there as well.
That's got to be one. Is that one of the hardest writing challenges in the world? Writing a horror film for kids.
Yeah, to make it creepy, but so that there isn't actual effluence.
Because the trouble is if you're doing a violent film, you can make it into slapstick humour or not show the violence. Yeah. But with a ghost story, sometimes the scariest stuff is the stuff that you don't actually see.
Yeah.
With the inference, so you can't just not. Sure, something.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
No, I agree. That must be quite a hard line to write.
Yeah,
kids' horror.
I suppose jump scares.
Yeah, sort of cheap.
You can get away with, can't you?
But yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, John, what have you got next for us from our lovely, lovely listeners?
I've got Doppelganger.
Is that by Christian Fieldhouse?
It is.
Yeah, I thought it was. Was.
Creepy.
Yeah. Sounds like exactly the kind of thing that Christian would send in.
And it goes like this. If Job had decided to stick around, this would have been his first white Christmas. Yesterday he was sat on a bench on the edge of the green with 8 cans of cider next to him, 6 of them empty. His view of the sprawling oak in the centre of the green was blurred by the tears that fell from his eyes to join the other detritus splattered at his feet. A young couple had stood next to the trunk of the tree, staring back towards him. He wasn't sure if they were real or a memory. It was cold and snow had started to fall. He had remembered meeting Charlotte for the first time by that tree, right there, after school. The sun had been shining on that day. The world had been a warm and beautiful place. He'd kicked his football deliberately her way just so he could fetch it and fall in love. A new bloke had been round on Wednesday night telling him how things were going to be. Not the first time in his house, by all accounts. He had heard the words, felt the threats and the veiled aggression, but could only think of Maisie and Evie, and his heart had ripped right there, right then. This was their first Christmas without him. Then he had remembered closing his eyes for a second, having drunk too much. They had usually played nicely together in the hallway, but when Maisie had let Charlotte in, Evie was burning things on the gas hob, and it hadn't gone down well. That was the last time he saw any of them. It had all been such a mess. The last can of cider had been warm and sickly, but it hadn't been about the taste at that stage, and he would need more before facing the inevitable. He had stockpiled enough pills and whiskey then. After that, it was just mechanics. The couple by the tree had moved forward towards him. He had wondered maybe if they were real after all. The snow had stuck to the grass, but not to them. She had glided across the ground with elegance.
while he had lolloped with a familiar gait. They had stopped directly in front of him on the bench, and Job had seen for the first time that this ethereal young woman with flowing robes was ever so slightly transparent. He had placed his drink down on the bench to somehow regain a sense of reality. Then, as he turned his head towards the young man, he had realized he was staring at a junior version of himself. Not a lookalike, not a dead ringer, him. He had stared into his own crystalline eyes as the youthful Job had leaned forward and whispered pointedly in his ear, "This will never happen. I promise."
What do you think of that, lads?
I was just going to say that I think I might have read that before by someone else. Looks exactly like him, but...
It's a doppelganger joke!
Yeah, no way!
Those go down about as well as geography jokes.
They do, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Move on from that.
Yeah. If you've ever got a joke about two countries that look exactly the same, nothing. Not worth doing. Don't mix the two. Don't cross the streams.
No.
I thought that was what a fantastic ending.
Yeah, it's very nice, isn't it?
Yeah, really, endings can be delivered so simply with such a simple line. Mm. It just opens up the entire story.
Makes you look back at it and go, oh.
I like that. Rejoining dots. Yeah.
It's massively ambiguous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or do you disagree?
Yes or no.
Ambiguity jokes. Those are good, yeah. Dave. Those always go down well. Those always go down well. Yeah. Sometimes.
I love stuff like that. I love when there isn't a distinct answer.
That's what I was going to say then. When you say it's ambiguous, it's like, well, that's ticked one of John's big tick boxes for it.
Yeah. Don't tell me everything. I want to swim around in it and sort of think about it myself.
Yeah,
There's plenty of that. It's like a little puzzle that you have to piece together. But it's very nice.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you, Christian.
Lovely. What's next, Tom?
Oh, it's my turn. Right. Oh, I like this one.
Does that mean that you haven't liked any of the other ones so far?
I hate it. Up to this point, this has just been a real, real slog day for me.
Yeah.
But thank God that Stephen Stilbeck wrote this one and sent it in. So this has kept me going. Yeah, this is Open Door by the previously mentioned Stephen Stilbeck. Let me tell you about the door. That way I can get it off my chest, see things clearly, get another perspective. I need perspective. I need to know it isn't just me. The door is open again. I closed it. I always close it. Or maybe I used to. I can't be sure. The thing is, it's my bedroom door. And it opens at night. When I'm lying in bed and there's no one else here, just me, the hotel, the dark, and the mountains. And I know I don't sleepwalk. I don't sleep. Not now. It's the off-season, the hotel is shut. I'm the only one here. That's what I was told. Keep the place secure, soul-free. Keep it warm, mold-free. Fix a few things. Enjoy the spa, the bar, the peace. Had to laugh. The place is falling apart. I doubt I'll finish the list of jobs they gave me before the spring comes and the shiny 4x4s arrive, spilling money all over the slopes. Still, it keeps me busy, keeps my mind from wandering. And there's the view. The glorious empty. The mountains, blue stone bones peeling snowy white flesh. I feel the shark teeth bedrock ripping the soft bellies of snow clouds as they pour out their guts. It comes in deep and fast and silent, like whatever opens my door at night. Sometimes I feel it first. My skin remembers the flicker of motion just before my senses return. It prickles alert, waiting, feeling the dark. "Something was here," it whispers. "Something was here." But my brain can't catch it, can't keep up with my skin and works against it, making up stories about what it could be. And in the story, it's gone. That's what we do, isn't it? Make up stories so we can explain things, like faith and Jesus and hope. Like the story I'm telling you now, and that feeling that gnaws at you. Like someone's watching you, listening to these words. Feel those eyes. Feel them on you. You turn and there's nothing. just an open door and the dark empty behind it. The mind plays tricks, but your skin is older, wiser, primal. And you want to return to the safety of your story and shed your scared skin because you want to know, I'm not really there. When I wake, I scream at myself until I get up. Out, I order myself. Get up, get up, get up. See what it is. Find fucking out, you piss yellow son of a bitch. My mind has to know. My mind doesn't really want to know what's behind the door. Why must they open it so? There are other doors. Why mine? Once I waited by the open door, I'd crossed the floor of my room so fast that before I understood why, I was standing in the sticky still dark, waiting. Instead of slamming the damn thing shut, I waited. 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 And nothing but darkness answered me. I couldn't see, but I could hear. Breathing. Labored, glottal. Then it stopped, as if whatever it was waiting too, listening to me. Maybe it was. With an axe, or a bad dream, or just another kind of hell. I couldn't tell. I slammed the door. Now it's fucking shut, I said. In the light, which is blue because the snow is blue under the winter rock, I cruise the hallways looking for open doors. I don't want to find one. I want to find one. It's hard to explain. If I find one, I know it's not just me they're picking on. If I don't, well, fuck, that doesn't help. No point thinking about it like that. But these doors are all closed. I nail them shut one by one by one. Nail those dark eye sockets shut. No more blankly staring out at the shitty patterned carpet and the peeling wallpaper. And behind those blank eyes. Oh, God. So I took my hammer and some nails and a fuckload of 2x4 and I sealed those suckers in. No one's opening those doors. Not nohow. And now at night the bedroom door is ajar. But my mind has caught up, and I have my hammer, and I'm going to nail that sucker to the door, nail them right in, bang their flesh clean through with nails and leave them hanging there, sealing them in the blue, blue mountains out.
See why you like that.
But it's good that as well. It's got like the echoes, hasn't it, of The Shining and
The Red Room.
Kind of classic
as
sort
well,
of,
is in there, H.G. Wells' Red Room, which weirdly is... Red Rum, similar, yeah. What am I trying to say?
It's similar
to Red Rum. I don't know what I'm saying. About. Just ignore me.
Yeah.
It just occurred to me that Red Rum sounds a bit like Red Room. Yeah, it's good. It's really good. There's a great bit in there. It's like he flips the narrator voice and he says, like the story I'm telling you now and that feeling that gnaws at you, like someone's watching you, listening to these words. Feel those eyes. Feel them on you. You turn and there's nothing. Just open a door and the dark empty behind it. The mind plays tricks, but your skin is older, wiser, primal. I thought that was so freaking
clever. Like a step out of the story.
The whole thing has been about, it's all been about my and his whole thing. And that is like a really clever little clue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Very, very clever. Mm. Yeah, he's a good writer, isn't he? That's fair to say.
Yeah. I quite like the bit, the idea... When he splits the brain and the skin, it's like from your conscious to your primeval reactions. And I thought that sort of the skin acting as sort of an early warning device in its own sense, as kind of like some highly tuned primeval thing that you can't control. Your brain's trying to catch up, but your skin, your basic, absolute gut instinct stuff, your fight or flight is there and it's screaming at you.
Very nice. Yeah. It also, it just the idea of a door opening, finding it open, and then closing it and then finding it open again. It's just great in it, in itself.
Yeah, it is. And to make it scary,
and
that's
always the best way of getting to the scares, is like, it's the little things that you can't quite explain. You don't need fireworks.
Yeah, it's almost you almost want it to be, well, that sounds fine.
Yeah.
Until the information's added in, you're, oh God, no, that's not fine.
Yeah, I like that. It's good. It's good.
Is this the last one? No, is this the last one?
Next to last. Your last one.
My last one. This is The Shadows of Sycamore Road by Simon Curtis. The rain kept falling. The wind blew it away from the window, but the incessant drip from the broken gutters made sure she knew it was not the time to head outside. There was no sign of the moon. If it was there, the thick clouds were keeping it from offering any kind of illumination to the sorry evening. She'd never been to this house before. It had been something of a last-minute decision. A friend of a friend had recommended her, and when the usual babysitter had been unavailable, she had been a truly fortunate discovery. She found the house without any problem. Everybody knew where Sycamore Road was. The houses were the biggest in town. Large, detached symbols of Victorian wealth, with their enormous gardens and three-story grandeur. She'd always wanted to have a look around one of them, and was excited by the request to look after the newly arrived doctor's two children. There had been apologies for the state of the house. They had only been there a week, and had a major modernisation job on their hands, as well as dozens of unopened boxes scattered around. It was very dusty. She'd smiled and gushed about how wonderful the house looked, that they should not worry, and for them to have a wonderful night. She mentioned looking forward to trying the biscuits that had been left out for her. There had been no mention of any problems with the electrics in the old building, but now, as she stood listening to the wind outside in the dark, she regretted not asking where the fuse box was. It was okay, though. She only had half an hour to wait, and the children hadn't stirred once. Until now. She used the torch on her mobile phone to navigate from the large, high-ceilinged living room to the open hallway. Carefully making her way across the uncarpeted wooden floor, each step seemed to creak. The entire hallway and staircase area were even darker due to the wood panelling, which, while enhancing the character in the light, made it challenging to see in the dark. Above her, at the top of the stairs, she could hear footsteps. One of the children must be awake. She steered herself around a couple of large and open boxes, and with one hand on the grand wooden banister, crept her way up the stairs. She heard another scuttle of small feet and a giggle as she climbed carefully up the steps. Which one was it, Toby or Leo? She hadn't met either, as they were asleep in their rooms when she arrived. As she reached the top of the first flight, she heard the telltale sounds of little bare feet and a door slam from down the corridor. She turned and flashed her torch, which did little to highlight the five doors. There was only one fully closed, so she softly walked up the corridor and to the room. She opened it and shone the torch into the blackness of a room filled with towers of boxes. She swept it around and was about to turn when she heard a muffled giggle from behind one of the piles of boxes. She walked slowly towards the sound. "I can hear you." There was a giggle and a flurry of footsteps behind her, and the door to the room slammed shut. She jumped in shock and spun around. A torchlight followed her, casting unnatural shadows around the room. Feeling uneasy, she lunged for the door and stepped out onto the landing, where she heard soft footsteps creeping up to the second floor. She scanned around to check all of the other doors were closed, and then made her way to the stairwell. As she tiptoed along, she could hear the telltale creaks as the little feet walked across the second floor landing. She picked up her pace, taking care in the pitch darkness, and hurried up the stairs. At the top, she saw one door open. She strode forward into the small bedroom. In the torchlight, it was clearly in need of updating, but fitting with the overall feel of the house. There was a small metal bed, a wardrobe, a small bookcase, and a bedside cabinet. There was a gap between the bed and the wall, just enough for a mischievous child to fit in. She crept up to the bed and looked down the side. There, looking up, was a small boy. "Come on, you, back to bed." She lifted the blanket and gestured for him to get in. He obliged, and without a word, put his head on the pillow and closed his eyes. She pulled the blanket over him, waited a moment until she thought he was asleep, and then left the room
following her torch. As she walked down the stairs to the first floor, she heard the grumbling of a baby stirring. She followed the sound to check on the other child and found a door on the first floor corridor with a dim light coming through the gaps. She carefully opened it. There was a battery-operated nightlight giving the room a dim but warm orange hue. As her eyes adjusted, she looked properly into the room where she saw two cots. Above each were nameplates. Toby above one, Leo the other. Without warning, the nightlight cut out, plunging her into darkness, and from above, she heard footsteps patter across the floorboards.
Creepy children.
Again. Exactly. Something little inherently bastards, creepy about children.
Creepy little
things.
They
really are, there,
aren't they?
They're just
creepy
little things. I mean, if it's the biggest sort of, you know, horror cliche. You go into a house and you hear children giggling.
Yeah.
You know that this is a scary place.
It's time to leave.
To leave. There are children here.
So I know that I'm being dim, right, about this. But I got slightly confused, and I want you guys to tell me that I'm being dim and explain it to me.
Okay.
Unless it's not explainable, if it's one of those. But I felt like the line, as her eyes adjusted, she looked properly into the room where she saw two cots. Above each were nameplates, Toby above one, Leo the other. And I felt like that was a reveal of some kind. And I got a bit confused. Did that mean cots as in like little baby cots? Because there's a baby sound. I got really confused.
I think it's because Toby and Leo are both babies.
Is that the idea that you're supposed to suddenly realise that they're babies, but they're not there, but they're older kids?
So who the hell is this?
But then they could just, I was just thinking, well, they could just be their old cots and the kids are a little bit old. I got a bit confused.
I think that Toby and Leo are in their cots. So who the hell's the other kid running around?
Ah, I thought they were empty. I saw them as empty. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Because he doesn't say,
Have I misunderstood?
No, because he doesn't say there were babies. There were little babies in the cots. It's just she saw the cots, and I thought they were empty. I don't know why, just that was how I saw it. Okay, yeah, that makes sense now. Yeah, okay, so the babies in the cots, so that other thing is something. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you, Dave, for explaining that. I don't know why I missed that.
Because there's the grumbling of a baby stirring. She hears the babies in the cots.
Yeah, that was what confused me.
Who's the creepy other child?
Yes.
And also the fact that she just says, come on, you, back to bed. And the child obliges without a word.
Yeah, that's suspicious.
And closes his eyes. That's clearly not a real child, is it?
Possessed, yes. Yeah.
Or it's just a really nice little kid, and they forgot to explain they had an older kid.
Yeah, you know? Yes.
And he's just a really nice guy.
Oh, good.
Yeah, this is the least, Simon, this is the least spooky story ever.
Yeah.
This is just a tale of everyday life. Yeah.
Two babies and a really nice older child. I'm getting retrospective chills now. I know that. Thanks.
Sort of Home Alone thing, and the doctor's just moved in there with his or her two children, and this other child is just left there from the previous tenant.
Yeah.
Just abandoned.
They've moved out and gone, oh, I'm sure we've forgotten something. And then they're on, you know, oh my God, we forgot Kevin.
Maybe, yeah. He's.
So it starts off as a horror story, and then the next chapter it becomes like a slapstick farce.
Nice. Very good, Simon. Well done, mate. Very good.
It's a John Hughes horror story.
Brilliant. And finally,
yes, we got one last one, and this is called Mabs, and it's by Jeffrey G. N. Harrison, and it goes like this. This happened when I was no more than 10 or 11 years old. My friends and I were playing cricket on Banktop Field. It was a bright autumnal day in late September. The sun had dropped down below the old buildings lining Whitelands Road, and we were all starting to think of our stomachs. Mine growled like a grizzly bear. I need to get home, said Paul. Mum will be wondering about me. I'll be lucky if she lets me out tomorrow. It's Saturday tomorrow. There's no school the day after, said Bruno. Yeah, I need to go too, I said. I'm starving. Bruno groaned. Paul laughed. Which way should we go? I asked. I didn't fancy going back the way we'd come. The route through the cut from the field to Curra Lane led right past the old abandoned cottage.
Come on, Scaredy, said Paul. It was Bruno who laughed then. Resigned, I packed up my stumps. Bruno retrieved his coat and his new bright red corky. We'd been playing with my old scuffed cricket ball. Bruno's was as red as a traffic light. Paul slung his bat over his shoulder and we set off. It was a well-oiled and cared-for bat, of which he was quite proud. It was getting dark through the cut by the time we reached it. Night was coming. The narrow run through the trees by old Mab's cottage was spookier than ever. I stopped a moment. My feet wouldn't move. My legs felt frozen solid. Paul, the youngest of our trio, ran on singing, Mab's dead, she's very, very dead, she lost her head when they found her. He was repeating the ditty as he ran into the gloom of the trees. Paul, don't, I grumbled, but he was gone and couldn't hear me. It was years since the previous owner, someone called Mab, lived in the old cottage. Rumours were rife about why she left and what happened to her son. Paul! Bruno and I shouted. There was a scream in the dark. Bruno set off running towards it. Reluctantly, I followed. Are you okay, Paul? I called, passing a rotting cricket bat lying on the ground. I saw Bruno just ahead. He was staring at the window on the first floor, his normally olive-coloured skin paler than snow. When I reached him, he wordlessly pointed to the window. Hanging over a beam in the upstairs room was a thick and dirty rope, covered in dusty cobwebs. Dangling from the rope was a child's body. The tatty, frayed and faded red jumper it wore looked just like Paul's.
Well, that's just that is a grim tale,
it's,
isn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty classic, that, isn't it? It's like an urban myth, that one.
Yeah, that's
it's got
yes.
that vibe,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like a little anecdote
yeah.
almost.
Yeah,
which is the thing that I really like about it. Mm. It's like the kind of tale that gets passed around playgrounds or is told by the fire.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, on camping
isn't
trips.
Isn't that exactly what? That's yeah. exactly what
told
just
by
happened,
the fire.
Isn't it?
Yeah. In a way, yeah.
Got told
no,
by
is,
a fire.
Yeah,
a
I thought that was excellent.
Good little bunch of stories there.
It was very, very creepy. I hope,
dear listeners.
Yeah, I hope you all had a little bit of creepiness, but not too much
yeah,
creepiness.
A pleasant level of festive
yeah.
creepiness.
There you go. Just the right level.
Just, yeah, just one little, just a little minute when you go down.
Enough to give you goosebumps, but not enough to physically shit yourself.
Yes, exactly.
The perfect amount.
Oh.
That's creepy because something.
What?
Was that someone coming in? What was that?
What?
I don't know. I just heard a really weird sound.
I didn't hear anything.
It just. Oh. My signal just cut out as though.
Just pop out and look behind you.
Don't want to open the door now. No.
Look outside your voice booth. Oh, no, sorry. Can't say that because we're in a.
Yeah, yeah, we're in the cabin. Yes, that's true. Let's not break the fourth wall.
So you didn't. Make that noise, Dave.
Well, I think my stomach might have rumbled.
Okay.
At the same time as the...
The disembodied child giggled in the background. But it's nothing to worry
yeah.
about. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm sure I heard
yeah.
something.
And that teddy bear in the corner just
anyway.
Turned its head.
Obviously just my imagination.
Yeah.
yeah.
So, well, that's a good old scary Christmas, isn't it? That's what you want from a traditional Christmas.
It is.
Being scared shit. It is the season of a strange man with a beard breaking into your house in the dead of night, isn't it?
Yeah.
And trying to give gifts to your children. So it is a creepy time of year.
It is. It's really true. I don't think I've really quite looked at it like that before, Dave. You put a whole new spin on it.
There you go.
It's thing. Fine, though, John, because he only does it after he's got them to sit on his knee and decide
right.
whether they're good or bad. So it's
yes.
it's absolutely
yes.
fine.
And he watches them when they sleep, does he? I think.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
With pen and paper in his hand. yeah.
Wow. Okay, well, on that note, do you think we should probably leave this place? Because I don't know about you guys, but I'm just a little bit freaked out by whatever that noise was.
Yeah.
yeah. And so was
I
it
feel like we should be heading back.
Is this an Airbnb? Do we have to clean it before we...
Yeah, no, it's... Well, we're going to have to pay quite a lot on the damage waiver.
Yeah.
After after we broke the fourth wall.
Yes.
That's
going to
be
we?
Pricey.
Yeah.
You know what Airbnb are like.
So that's a deposit gone. So, yeah, I suppose I better go back out into the wilderness then.
am I? If we can't stay here any longer.
Yeah, well, I think we should all head off. But hey, thank you for listening, listeners. And I think we're going to take a little bit of a break.
Yeah, just while we find a way home from the cabin.
Exactly.
So maybe 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah. So we'll be back, but we won't be back in 2 weeks as normal. It'll be a little bit longer. So.
But thank you for listening all through 2023. We do appreciate it very, very much.
We do. And if you can bring yourself to maybe review us, of course, make sure that you subscribe to the podcast and tell a couple of people about the podcast. Always helps.
Spread it around.
Yeah, spread it around.
Around a campfire.
Spread it around a campfire.
Sit around a fire. Set a fire and...
Hang on, Dave.
Tell
we get into a-
the people who come to the fire all
we're gonna
about
We're going to get into
us.
A lot of legal problems here, Dave, if we tell people to set fire to stuff.
Oh, you want...
Just set fire to the nearest thing to you and start screaming about the Failing Writers podcast at the top of your voice. That'd be all right, wouldn't it? That'd be fine.
Yeah, yep. We've definitely got a lot.
Yeah, nothing could go
lots
wrong
Lots of
there,
attention for that. Brilliant. Well, Dave, it has been bloody lovely hanging out with you,
isn't
mate.
Isn't it nice, Dave?
Well, it's been lovely
up,
to be
it?
Back, you
what
know.
A pleasant surprise.
Yeah, it's been nice to
Hey, do we have a little group hug? Oh, come on, bring it in. Come on. Right. Come on. Ooh, here we go.
Everything smells of smoke in here.
There we go. How's that feel?
Nice.
That's nice. And that's been a while. Right. Time to head off. Get your wellies on. And... we'll see you in a while.
Yes.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year. Oh, you're still doing the party blower sound effect then, Dave?
That was a party blower.
That didn't... Was that a party... Did it go? I was going to say, you've got a frog in your throat or something, because that wasn't as
that.
High quality
yeah.
as it normally is.
No. Well, I haven't had the chance to practice, have I?
So. Go on, one more.
Oh, that was a good one.
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?